You are listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. As the midterm election season gears up, there's one open seat in Washington getting a lot of attention. The job of Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, is not seeking re-election, so Republicans need to figure out who will replace him. On the short list is Steve Scalise from Louisiana. A year ago, Scalise nearly died from a gunshot wound after a gunman attacked members of Congress at baseball practice. Since then, he's recovered his mobility and become a darling of his party and President Trump. Elena Plott, who's been following Scalise for The Atlantic, is out with a new story for the magazine called The Man Who Would Be Speaker. Elena Plott, welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much for having me, Jonathan.
So, Elena, before we talk about Congressmember Scalise, let's talk about how the Republican Party is doing in general. Is the party in disarray or at least suffering from an identity crisis? I'm thinking back, and I'm sure you know, that event that former Speaker John Boehner did where he talked about how there's no Republican Party anymore. It's the Trump Party. What's your perspective as someone who covers Congress?
Honestly, it's such a perfect day for this question, Jonathan. I'm on the Hill right now as we speak, and this morning the House Republican Conference convened for 2 hours to try to hammer out once and for all what the party wants to do about immigration moving forward, and specifically about the fate of Dreamers. This is something that kind of bedeviled both factions of the party, more moderates and conservative Freedom Caucus types. And for the first time, we're actually seeing moderates pushing Republican leadership to act on immigration. And, you know, even after this two-hour meeting, there was really no resolution whatsoever. Leadership, of course, is committing, as they always do, to more conversations. But once again, I think we're seeing immigration talks end in a stalemate. So I think the word disarray is actually pretty apt in terms of, you know, whether there's any future for kind of ideological cohesion within the Republican Party. And that doesn't really bode well for their chances in the midterm.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, I'm glad you brought up the immigration fight, because it's a little bit complicated. I think a lot of people who might be listening thought that immigration was dead on Capitol Hill. But behind the scenes, there's this thing been happening, a movement on a discharge petition. Talk about what a discharge petition is and why that is essential to that two-hour caucus meeting that just happened.
Right. So like I mentioned, leadership was pretty much taken aback by moderates for the first time, kind of saying, we're going to be the renegades and prepare for action. We're not just going to go along, get along, as we've been known to. A discharge petition is actually something that's very rarely used. It triggers what's known as a Queen of the Hill process. So should they get the 218 signatures they need for the discharge petition, essentially any immigration bill can go to the floor. It's an opportunity for members to go on the record for the bill that they think best represents themselves, their constituents, and so on. But what will likely happen and what leadership is hoping to avoid in this discharge petition is that something goes to the floor that probably 30 moderate Republicans support, like just a blanket extension of DACA that all Democrats sign on for. And then that means that the House conference led by Republicans ends up passing that bill. And that's something conservatives who don't want to touch that have to answer to on the stump in the fall, even if it's something they didn't vote for. So leadership doesn't want to put conservatives in that position. But moderates at this point know that, you know, they're also vulnerable and their constituents are demanding action on DACA. So this is a way for them to get on the record saying, look, I tried to do something about it. The Senate won't touch it. It won't go to the president's desk. But here's my name saying that, you know, I want to help codify these kids into citizenship.
And so then let's bring in the House Majority Whip, Steve Scalise of Louisiana. Since he's a member of the leadership, is it safe to assume that this whole discharge petition and the issue of immigration is something that he just wants to avoid with a 10-foot pole?
Absolutely. Both he and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy would so much rather this not be even a point of passion right now. I think they'd rather that immigration not be on the table at all going into the fall, just because it's an opportunity for members of the Freedom Caucus to get angry at them and say, our leadership failed us. This discharge petition went through. We weren't able to come up with a solution, which is what you leadership are tasked with doing. And for Steve Scalise and Kevin McCarthy, both of whom, you know, do want the speakership, that's not a great place to be in, because the Freedom Caucus, of course, is composed of members who can unilaterally decide pretty much who gets the job in the fall, if that makes sense. So they don't want to be, you know, spending their time making uncomfortable calls with these conservatives saying, sorry, this is what you're going to have to put up with.
How many members? So there's always a lot of talk about the Freedom Caucus and the power that they wield. It's not that they are a majority of the Republican caucus, but they are a significant minority in that the leadership can't really do anything without getting the Freedom Caucus's support, right?
That's absolutely correct. So it's about 40 members of kind of conservative hardliners in the House. And because 218 votes are needed for a piece of legislation currently to pass in the House, if the Freedom Caucus decides they don't want to be on board and vote against a measure en bloc, and of course Democrats also decide they're not going to vote for a measure on the floor, then the bill is all but dead. So what ends up happening there, Jonathan, is if, you know, leadership feels strongly about, say, a budget deal, as we saw in February, about it needing to get passed, they end up having to rely on Democrats and are forced to kind of negotiate with Nancy Pelosi. And legislation, I think, ends up becoming more liberal in the end because Freedom Caucus members don't want to go on board.
So, Elena, Your piece is titled "The Man Who Would Be Speaker," and it's all about Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip. When Speaker Ryan announced that he was not going to seek re-election, you open your piece with this vignette of House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy calling a meeting with Congressmember Scalise and one other member of the leadership to basically buttonhole them into supporting him, meaning McCarthy. But Congressmember Scalise, Whip Scalise, after that meeting, goes on television and kind of doesn't announce that he's going to support the majority leader, Congressman McCarthy, for the position. How is it that McCarthy seems to be facing a challenge from a man, Scalise, who most people didn't know about even a year ago?
Well, you're absolutely right. Whip Scalise is someone who has always been kind of a reliable conservative within the House, has always engendered goodwill among members, but he didn't really have that kind of pizzazz that, you know, someone like Kevin McCarthy, he is this flamboyant backflapper who, you know, I wrote this in the piece, you stand in front of him and you can't help but be seduced into believing you're in the presence of a political mastermind. Steve Scalise is not necessarily like that. So it's been, I think, hard for him to kind of figure out a way to break through that ceiling. As taboo and crass as it sounds, what happened to him last year on the baseball field when, like you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, he nearly died, offered an opportunity for Americans to get to know him. And that's hugely important, I think, in terms of engendering the popular support and goodwill that can really help in these leadership elections. A lot of members who are close to him told me that, you know, for the first time, I think Americans were seeing that there are members of Congress who are resilient. And Congress is not very popular right now.
Yeah.
So when you do have a figure who seems able to cross party lines in terms of, you know, engendering support and goodwill, that's really, really meaningful. So I think, yes, Steve Scalise has always wanted to move up in leadership. That's not a question. But I think, you know, the way he's persevered in the aftermath of the shooting has kind of provided the opening he's always needed.
So, Elena, tell us about more about Congressmember Scalise's background. I've mentioned several times he's from Louisiana, but how did he get into politics?
He grew up in a family that really didn't have much to do with politics at all, just a very normal middle-class family, brother, sister. And when he was in college, he, as he told me, he listened to a gubernatorial debate on campus at LSU, his alma mater, and just decided, you know, I don't like the direction of my state and I'd like to get involved. So in 2002, as a 29-year-old, he ran for the state house and had no money. His family didn't have money. You know, it's great to hear him talk about sort of the $10 spaghetti dinners that he would throw as fundraisers. And he ended up winning that race and hasn't lost any race since. And, you know, it's just a testament to kind of how good he is, I think, as a campaigner and connecting to people, that he was able to win Bobby Jindal's seat, even when his name ID at that time wasn't great.
When he went to this debate that you mentioned at his alma mater, LSU, and that sparked his interest in politics, and you said he didn't like the direction his state was going in. The message he was hearing wasn't conservative enough? Because right now, he's one of the most conservative members of Congress.
You know, it's an interesting question, Jonathan. One thing I really tried to, you know, ask and press Scalise on is how his conservative ideology formed. You know, why is he right-wing? And I actually don't think there's a great answer as to what made him conservative. I think a lot of times we sort of bend to the will of those who are around us, where we grow up. A lot of it is the culture we come from. But I think, you know, what he saw in the Democratic governor who was on the stage that day was someone who was driving jobs away, at least he felt, from Louisiana. And I think that's where the seeds of sort of a kind of pro-jobs, pro-capitalism started to form. But there really is no great answer as to, you know, he didn't read Edmund Burke one day and decide, you know, this fits, this feels right to me, or anything like that. I think it really started with a pro-jobs message and kind of spun out from there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your description of him that, you know, his views are right-wing. I want to get your perspective on a scandal that he was a part of a few years ago, and that had to do with him speaking at an event affiliated with neo-Nazis. I remember at the time that it was a big deal then. I think today it would be an even bigger deal. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this story broke in 2014. It was it actually had taken place in 2002 when, like I mentioned, he had just become a member of the state house. He was invited to speak at a group with affiliations with David Duke, and he did speak in front of that group. He really just talked about taxes in his speech. But a Mother Jones reporter, I think it was in 2014, sort of broke the fact that, you know, he had spoken to that group, and that really, you know, demanded an explanation. Mm-hmm. And I think in the last several years, congressional reporters, having prodded him for a long time on this, have really, really have come to believe that he had no idea the affiliations of this group. A lot of other members have come forward to, you know, attest to the fact that they know what's in his heart, and racism is not it. That's what we have to take for face value right now. But he has vehemently denied ever since the news broke, ever mm-hmm. knowing the group's affiliation.
I'm speaking with Elena Plott, a staff writer at The Atlantic who covers Congress, about her recent piece on House Majority Whip Steve Scalise titled "The Man Who Would Be Speaker." This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and with me is Elena Plott, staff writer for The Atlantic. We're talking about her latest piece, "The Man Who Would Be Speaker." That person is House Majority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana. So, Elena, how does Steve Scalise go from being a freshman member of Congress to being in the leadership, and particularly as a conservative member of Congress? What was his path once he got to Capitol Hill?
So there's something in the House Republican Conference called the Republican Study Committee. It's something that Newt Gingrich was famously a part of and spearheaded. It was kind of the Freedom Caucus before the Freedom Caucus, I think is the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. And at this point, it's grown to a sizable portion of the conference, 140 members, who sort of meet to craft conservative alternatives to whatever it is that leadership is putting forth. It's always been seen, if you can get the chairmanship of that committee, that you might have a platform to one day being in leadership of the whole conference. Steve Scalise did win the chairmanship of the Republican Study Committee and was the underdog in his bid for that. So he has shown before that he doesn't have to be the kind of de facto, you know, next in line or the endorsed pick for the positions he wants. He does have a history of kind of coming from behind and taking gavels. Mm-hmm. But it was really, I think, his leadership of that committee where he showed reporters, observers, that he is staunchly conservative and he is committed to conservative ideology, I think, in a way that even maybe Paul Ryan might not be, especially in areas such as immigration. And I think that was key for him in terms of showing members for his run for majority whip that he was, in fact, conservative and he wouldn't drop that just because had a seat at the leadership table. Mm-hmm.
What's interesting in your description of how he became the chair of the Republican Study Committee is that he was elected. I think a lot of people tend to think that these committee positions are appointed by the actual leader of the party on the Hill, by the speaker or by the majority leader. And at least within the Republican caucus, folks like Congressman Scalise, they have to run and get their colleagues to vote for them to get into these very influential positions.
Right. And it's a lot like it would be if you were running for any other office across the country. I talked to so many House Republican members for this story who their first memories of Steve Scalise was when they were elected as freshmen, hadn't even gotten to D.C. yet. And their first call was from Steve Scalise, someone they had never heard of, saying, "Hi, I'm running for Republican Study Committee. I think this is something you'd probably like to be a part of. Would you consider voting for me?" So, you know, yeah, it's aggressive, it's intense. And one point I'd like to make is that even with Donald Trump and kind of this wave of outsider sentiment, Congress is still a place where people really do value seniority and who's next in line. And, you know, that can really, you know, be a factor when you're running for the top of the committee. Who is it that leadership wants, and how do I convince people to sort of buck those trends of seniority and elect me instead?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, since you mentioned his name, President Trump, let's talk about him, because was Scalise always a big Trump supporter during the campaign?
So he didn't endorse Trump until May 2016. And at that point, of course, it was pretty clear that Trump would take the Republican nomination. But he was not someone who, during the primary, had ever said bad things about Trump. Obviously, there are a lot of Republican lawmakers who Trump has made either repent or punished for their, you know, daring to say something not lovely about him during the primary. Scalise was actually politically smart, I think, in keeping his mouth shut. But when he was in May 2016, he was in. And to this day, I think they have a pretty strong relationship. But no, it was not his instinct at all to go for Trump when the primary began.
You know, I interviewed Matt Schlapp, the head of the American Conservative Union, who I know you know, and I asked him, why do or did evangelicals support President Trump, a person who had been married three times, done all sorts of things that would run counter to their moral beliefs? And the thing that Matt Schlapp said to me was that they liked him, like Trump, because he fights. They like a fighter. Congressman Scalise is a deeply Christian Republican. Mm-hmm. Despite the president's many infidelities, is behind the president 100%. Why do you think the majority whip is able to put aside his values, his moral core, to support this president?
I think it's such a good question, and I think that as reporters, we're always looking for this answer, and we're never quite satisfied by the one we get. I asked Scalise about this when we sat down for an interview in his high school back in Louisiana, and his answer to me was just that, you know, Donald Trump would bring kind of the pro-growth policies that would drive the economy in a way that Hillary Clinton never could, which of course, you know, begs so many more questions. You know, our pro-growth policies, do those always come ahead of ethics or a moral core, just, you know, a broader vision for the character of a nation? And, you know, I didn't really get a good answer for that. So I asked about the Access Hollywood tape specifically. And rather than even admitting, as I think a lot of people can at this point who support Trump, that, you know, it was terrible, it should be, you know, he should be condemned for that, but he was still my guy. Scalise only said to me, you know, I think that was malicious on the part of the media to drop it when they did. They dropped it because they wanted Hillary Clinton to win, which there's, of course, no evidence of that. But I am still longing as a reporter to talk to a member who is a Christian like I am, and just be honest about questions they've wrestled with when it comes to being faithful to this president and their party, but also, you know, what they believe.
You know, in your conversations with Congressman Scalise, did you see a tension between his faith and his Trumpism?
I didn't see that tension, and I don't know if I think that's because it's not there necessarily, but because Republican lawmakers are so ready for this question at this point. It's been over a year of Donald Trump in office, and I think they really do sort of have their script ready anytime a reporter asks about this, specifically vis-a-vis religion. So, you know, I can't give you a great answer as to whether he does still grapple with that tension, but what I know is no Republican is surprised anymore when they get that question. It would not at all surprise me if they hold, like, I don't know, early morning sessions of how to respond to it.
A messaging meeting.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So, Elena, you write that a partnership between Trump and Scalise, quote, could enshrine Trumpism as the future of the GOP. It could enshrine Trumpism as the future of the country, too. What do you mean by this?
What I mean by that is the Speaker of the House wields an enormous amount of influence, of course, and especially if Republicans keep the House and Republicans keep the Senate, the person who succeeds Paul Ryan will be super close to President Trump, will be able to kind of engineer the exact sort of proposals he wants to make it to the House floor. And, my, you know, Paul Ryan, as I write in the piece, has been a pretty dutiful foot soldier for Trump, but I think vis-a-vis immigration specifically, Paul Ryan has been unwilling to kind of bang the gavel and say, listen, we want a wall. This is what Trump campaigned on. We're going to make it happen. Steve Scalise is someone who I believe would do that, because while Paul Ryan doesn't agree with President Trump on immigration, Steve Scalise does. So sort of those core policies that make up Trump's ideology, how, you know, if you can call it that, Steve Scalise is right on board. It's not that he just wants to please Trump, make nice with him. He actually does believe in it.
Mm-hmm. You know, Elena, I've got to, we got to talk about the EPA. Because you are at the center of what is happening, the other scandal that's happening with the EPA administrator. When you called an EPA spokesperson, he didn't have a comment on your latest story about the aide who was, you know, dispatched to go buy a used mattress from the Trump hotel. But anyway, the spokesperson, in response to your legitimate questions about what was happening, wrote back to you saying, you have a great day, you're a piece of trash. As someone who covers Congress, and you have been covering Congress and politics for you know, since pre-Trump, is this the new normal?
I like to think it's not. And the reason I say that is because having been a Hill reporter for a few years now, I really do, you know, I'm being sincere when I say the vast majority of my relationships with press secretaries, communications officials here on the Hill is so cordial, helpful, professional, all those, you know, terrific adjectives I can come up with. And I do think that's because Congress, in terms of professionalism, remains insulated in some ways from the whims of this White House, because so many of the people who are here, who I work with, were here long before Trump and plan to be here long after Trump. So I like, you know, I would hope that this is just a function of sort of, you know, what these officials see from the White House in terms of what's acceptable for treating a reporter, and that when Trump is not in office, maybe that will go away. But yeah, it is being a Hill reporter in those moments and remembering that not all press officials are like this.
Well, you know, you used a great word just now, insulated, that members of Congress are insulated from the whims of the White House. And it made me think, how on earth is it possible that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt still remains insulated from the calls that he stepped down and resigned? Why does President Trump not call on him to resign or fire him, given all of these stories that you've written and other reporters have written?
The honest answer, Jonathan, is I don't know. I think that would require me to probe the psyche of Trump in ways that I'm just not capable of doing. The only theory that made any amount of sense to me is something that I was talking with Peter Baker at the New York Times about. And what he said to me was that, you know, I think in Scott Pruitt, Trump sort of sees a version of himself, which is that this is someone who negative headlines come out each day. People are lobbying against him to resign, to quit, to apologize, and he never bends to that will. And that's very Trumpian, if you think about it. There is a shamelessness, I think, that connects them. And, you know, what Peter said to me is, I can only assume that Trump sees himself in Pruitt, and that's why he keeps him around. But again, you and I could touch base in 8 hours, and all that could change. So I'm not sure.
Right. Well, let's bring it back to the person we invited you on to talk about, and that's House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. He gave you a lot of access to do this story. Why do you think that is? Is he making a really big play to become Speaker?
Part of it, yes. But going back to our earlier conversation, I also think that press officials on the Hill are pretty open with their members and finding time for reporters who do want to do kind of a good faith long form profile. This is something that Scalise had never had before, which is part of the reason I pitched it. There was no kind of comprehensive 4,000 word piece out there looking at who he is, where he grew up, his family life, his early political career. And I think that, you know, most people on the Hill can see the value in having that for their member. So I would say that's the big reason. But of course, you know, it's not bad to have a profile come out for you. And, you know, in the scene with a resilient kind of triumph on the baseball field when you happen to watch.
Elena, I'm going to have to cut you off because I've got 10 seconds to tell people to read your article for The Atlantic, The Man Who Would Be Speaker, by Elena Plott, staff writer at The Atlantic.